friend of mine, who is a man of letters and a philosopher, said to me one day, as if between jest and earnest, "Fancy, since we last met, I've discovered a haunted house in the midst of London."
HPPodcraft.com.
All right, that's a good beginning to a haunted house story by Edward Bulwer Lytton called The House and the Brain.
And you're joining us here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and we're talking about Mr. Bulwer Lytton because he was talked about by Mr. H.P. Lovecraft in his essay, Supernatural Horror in Literature.
Not only there, I think Lovecraft actually even referenced him in some of his stories. He was a big fan of this author. Now, who is the reader that we just heard?
The reader is a friend of the show, John Hancock, and you might recognize his lovely voice from YSDC's The Silver Lodge. He is also an awesome ukulele player.
Do you guys get together and jam on the
ukes? We've jammed a couple times, yeah. It's tough because we can only play the same thing at the same time, you know, like...
Right, you can't just improv and follow
like,
each other.
Yeah, it's not... It's like, we both know these songs and we can play the songs, so we're playing the exact same thing. Maybe the rhythm's right. A little different. But we're not doing harmonies. We're not doing any of that stuff. But it's still fun. And he's a great guy.
It's kind of like in when you first get into band and the first thing you play is like Popeye the Sailor Man all together.
Exactly.
There's no melody or exactly. There's no harmonies or anything like that.
Seriously, he's an outstanding player and a great guy. So thanks for doing the reading, John.
Awesome. Well, it sounds good. Thanks, John. The story that we're doing is called The House and the Brain, as I said, but it's also called The Haunted and the Haunters.
I like the brain better.
Yeah, I do too. And it also fits our theme because we're doing body part stories.
Exactly.
Let's say, you know, the brain is a body part. But when you heard that title, what did you think the story was going to be about?
What immediately popped into my head were the brain people from Futurama.
Yeah, I guess I thought the same thing, except I was thinking, and this might be connected to that, was Fiend Without a Face.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That movie where they're invisible for most of the movie. But at the end, they appear in their brains with antennae. But yeah, I thought there would be some kind of severed hovering brain involved.
There isn't.
Spoiler alert, there isn't. So no. I was a little disappointed about that. Before we get into this, there's a lot of bad press about this author. I thought maybe we could settle a couple of things about it.
Yeah.
Some people say he's the worst ever, or at least I saw that floated around on the internet. And I wouldn't say that's true.
Not
at all.
Even close, man.
There are some bad ones.
This story's pretty enjoyable. Up to the end, a little shaky, but it's still some cool stuff and it's very creepy.
Yeah, it's got some really great description and some neat things happen in it. I think that there are sections of this story where he really overdoes it. He takes a long time to say something, or maybe he's too descriptive. And I think that that's the thing that is carried away, that people are talking. Well, he was very popular through much of the 19th century. I mean, really popular. He was a famous author. But he wrote this one sentence in his novel, Paul Clifford, that is what he sort of remembered for.
Right.
It was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in torrents, except at occasional intervals when it was checked by a violent gust of wind which swept up the streets. For it is in London that our scene lies, rattling along the housetops and fiercely agitating the scanty flame of the lamps that struggled against the darkness.
Well, yeah, okay, that's not so good.
Right.
I've heard people complain about how that was one of the worst lines written ever. It was dark and stormy night. And that's all I heard was the first part of it. And I thought to myself, that's not so bad.
Yeah.
Just because it's night doesn't necessarily mean it's dark, because there could be street lights. There could be.
Sure.
You know, and whatever. I'm like, okay, what's the big deal? And then I read the whole sentence and I go, okay, now I understand why everybody's been out of shape about this.
Poe even uses the line, it was a dark and stormy night. People think he might have been making fun of.
He was totally making fun of him, because what he said was, it was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in cataracts.
Yeah, right.
Made it really short.
What story is that from?
The Bargain Lost.
Well, there is a lot going on in that sentence that Lytton wrote, and that's why there's this annual Bulwer Lytton Fiction Contest, which we'll link out to if you want to check it out, because I think they actually just announced a winner recently. But basically, the contestants think up terrible one-sentence openings for imaginary novels. We've actually discussed it on this show before. It's a really amusing way to run a contest. Maybe too bad that that's the one way that he's remembered. There's some other things that, some other sort of famous sayings that survive from his fiction, like we talked about last week, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Yeah, yeah.
The great unwashed, right? And the almighty dollar.
Which is strange, being that he's an Englishman.
Yeah, it is strange. A couple of things that I found interesting when I was reading up on him recently was that he had this super contentious relationship with his wife.
Oh, dude, yeah, I've read about that. That's awesome, man.
He was wealthy and had cash, you know, he had an inheritance. But then he married this woman, Rosina Doyle Wheeler, who was a famous Irish beauty. I also think her mother was a writer and active in political rights, that sort of thing. It was against his mother's wishes. And so when he married her, she withdrew his allowance and he had to work for his money. Wah.
Boo-hoo.
But that was in 1827 and they separated in 1833, which maybe was because he was philandering a little bit.
Yeah.
Then things went really crazy, right?
He was running for parliament. She just started ripping on him. She wrote some books. She published some things about him that were pretty libelous about her husband and all the things that he'd done. And he got so angry at her, he threatened to like go after her publishers and withhold money that he was giving her and not let her see the kids. And then finally he had her institutionalized.
Yeah. It was during like a stump speech or something like that. She showed up and was denouncing him in front of everybody.
Yeah.
And then he said, oh, she's crazy. And she got institutionalized for it.
For weeks.
Her lawyers managed to get her out. And then she wrote a book about that as well called A Blighted Life later. Yeah. In 1880. But once they split up, she never stopped attacking her husband.
It's crazy.
And he was a politician his whole life as well. He was a famous author who had different posts throughout his life.
Now, did he have some kind of connection to Great Expectations?
Yeah, he was good friends with Charles Dickens. After Dickens had finished Great Expectations, he actually was taking a break and he came to stay with Bulwer Lytton. Kind of out of character for Dickens, he said, well, why don't you have a read of the book? I mean, it wasn't submitted to the publishers yet.
Mm-hmm.
When he read it, he really liked it, but kind of like a Hollywood guy said, it needs a more up ending because at the end, you know, Pip and Estelle don't get together. And
what?
So, oh no, I spoiled it for everyone.
Oh man.
Dickens rewrote it so that you can take out of it that Pip and Estella kind of walk off into the sunset together. So he made a change. Now, I mean, that last sentence of that book is kind of ambiguous. I always thought that they didn't get together.
Right, of course.
But he did at least pull a little more towards Bulwer Lytton's recommendation, which is crazy.
Wow.
You know, I don't think that was something that he typically did. Big influence on a great book.
Do you know what I know what H.P. Lovecraft thought about it.
Yeah, why don't you tell me?
I set myself up for that.
Yeah, you did.
Did you hear that?
That was really good.
This is what Lovecraft has to say about Bulwer Lytton. At this time, the mid-1800s, a wave of interest in spiritualistic charlatanry, mediumism, Hindu theosophy, and such matters, much like that of the present day, were flourishing, so that the number of weird tales with a psychic or pseudoscientific basis become very considerable. For a number of these, the prolific and popular Lord Edward Bulwer Lytton was responsible, and despite the large doses of turgid rhetoric and empty romanticism in his products, his success in the weaving of a certain kind of bizarre charm cannot be denied. The House and the Brain, which hints of Rosicrucianism, and at a malign and deathless figure perhaps suggested by Louis XV's mysterious courtier Saint Germain, yet survives as one of the best short haunted house tales ever written.
In Lovecraft's time, you know, there was so much of that crazy mediumship seances and things. And so that was very popular at the time. Bulwer Lytton was writing mid 19th century as well.
Now, honestly, that's something we never really talk about.
Yeah. Well, the stuff never really goes away, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in like the 50s and 60s, you didn't hear much of that stuff.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
But I mean, you know, even in the late, kind of the turn of this last century, it's something about the turn of the century, it seems. I mean, it's sort of on the downswing now, but, you know, Sylvia Brown, and I still see posters here all over the time for psychics coming to pubs. It's crazy.
And also referenced in that passage is Saint Germain, who's an interesting character in history. He jumped around. He was in Louis XV's court, but he also was in London and he was a musician and he wrote a ton of music. But he also said he was 300 years old. He always had stories about how he's immortal and that kind of thing. So I didn't really see that in this.
Well, I think it's the end.
Yeah. So where we're just going to do the basics since this story is so wordy. A friend tells our narrator that he found a haunted house in London. She says, you know, 6 weeks ago, my wife and I were looking for a place to stay. We found this joint, fit all of our requirements. So we went in, and then the third day we were out of there. Nothing could have convinced us to stay.
Yeah.
There's a great sentence here where he goes, the strangest marvel of all was that for once in my life, I agreed with my wife, silly woman though she is, and allowed after the third night that it was impossible to stay a fourth. So maybe that's a little insight into Bulwer's marital troubles, I thought, there, if that's his opinion towards wives. Now, there's a woman who keeps the house. She says when they're leaving, well, they've been very kind to you. Few have ever stayed a second night. They who haunt the house, and I once lived in this house, not as a servant, but as a lady. Now I'm a servant. I don't care. I'm old. I'm going to die soon, and then I'm going to join them. So we have those facts at least.
Yeah.
Before the narrator, who's a skeptic, says, that sounds awesome. I really want to stay a haunted house, so I'm going
to
go.
He goes to the house. The guy gives him the address. He goes to the house. He's looking for the landlord. The house is all closed up, locked up. He doesn't understand what's going on. And then there's a beer boy collecting pewter pots. I've never heard this term before. I'm sure this is a plucky Cockney kid. He says, you know, hey, do you know who who runs this place. Oh, the lady that runs this place, she's dead. She died 3 weeks ago. And he's like, oh, man. He goes, but Mr. J, he's the guy that runs the place. In the story, all the names have been blocked out, so it's just J.
What the boy says is, and you know he's a little cockney kid, the old woman who kept it was found dead in a bed with her eyes wide open. They say the devil strangled her. That's the first detail.
He goes to talk to Mr. J. He goes, hey, I'd love to rent out your place. J says, hey, you don't even have to rent it out. If you got the cojones to stay there, you can stay there for free as long as you want. I couldn't stay there for more than 3 hours. That place is haunted. I can't rent it out. It's horrible. Have fun.
Yeah. And he tells a few stories of people who've rented it and run away. It's a very typical kind of haunted house thing. What's interesting is that nobody's ever reported the same phenomena. They've been different for everybody.
Right.
Which was sort of the setup for Richard Matheson's Hill House as well. This reminded me a lot of that.
It could have inspired it.
The lady who lived there, it also mentions in that part that she said even 30 or 40 years ago when she had lived there, it was haunted then too.
Been so, haunted a long time.
Yeah. He goes back home. He gets a servant and he's like, hey, you remember in Germany how disappointed we were at not finding a ghost in that old castle, which was said to be haunted by a headless apparition? So these guys are like ghost hunters.
Yeah, they're super into it.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh yeah, I remember. He goes, well, F, because that's what he calls him, F, we're going to go check out this haunted house. I think it's the real deal. And he's like, oh, yeah, kick ass. Let's do it. You know, he's super psyched about it. Our guy, the narrator of the story, has to go work. He works late. He sends his servant over there to set up the house for them to stay in. Right as he goes, he talks about his dog. He's going to bring a dog with him.
Yeah, it's a great description.
I took with me a favorite dog, an exceedingly sharp, bold, and vigilant bull terrier, a dog fond of prowling about strange ghostly corners and passages at night in search of rats. A dog of dogs for a ghost.
That should be in the Bulwer Lytton fiction contest. A dog of dogs for a ghost.
I think this is a plot germ for one of your short stories about dogs.
I know. I love dogs and monsters.
Perfect.
Hey, wait a minute. I think I just came up with the title of my anthology.
Dogs and Monsters.
Dogs and Monsters.
Perfect.
All right. Well, he shows up about 9:30. The servant's like, I heard the sounds of pattering feet that I couldn't explain, but other than that, it hasn't been too scary.
Nothing. Yeah, he's kind of disappointed
that
it hasn't been that scary.
And then they check out the entire house. There's it's a pretty gloomy place. There's a basement. There's a slick little patio out in the back. The dog hates the whole experience, wants to leave the whole time. But it takes a little bit of time, then the supernatural stuff starts to happen. A footprint suddenly forms itself on the ground right in front of our protagonist.
Small footprint, like that of a child.
Right. A minute later, he goes into a room. The servant's not in there. And as he sits down, a chair goes and turns opposite of him and moves. I mean, so this isn't subtle. This place is freaking haunted.
Yeah, this isn't just a kind of a creepy noise or a cool breeze. It's freaking stuff's moving around and things that shouldn't be able to happen are happening.
And when the servant moves the chair back into place, he gets even struck on the shoulder by something. They're very, you know, we shall catch them before they frighten us. You know, they're not letting this bother them.
Yeah, they still think that this might be a trick. They think that somebody's pulling something, you know.
Right.
They're trying to keep this house empty. So they're, I mean, these guys are hardcore skeptics.
They are. And it gets pretty menacing for them in a bit because after they wander around a little more. And then they see this door open on its own.
It's a door that wouldn't open earlier.
Exactly.
But then now it's just open. And then they go into the room. It closes behind them and locks. And they can't get out of it. I mean, they even try to bust the door down. And they can't get out. Now, I was, oh, God, that's pretty scary. Because who's going to get them out of there? They're going to have any food or water or anything like that.
Yeah. And it's like there's no furnishing in the room. There's only one window that shows down to the patio. But it's just a blank room and they can't get out. And that's pretty menacing, actually.
And honestly, I'm super into the story at this point still.
Yeah, me too.
Very scary.
The description is good. It's got a great feel. Unfortunately, though, after a couple of minutes, the door opens again.
Then that wasn't so scary.
And they're able to leave, but they see some apparition on the stairs, and they follow it. It goes into a bedroom, which seems to be some kind of servant's room.
In the attic bedroom.
They go through the stuff that's up there.
And they find some letters.
Right.
Now, these are from about 35 years ago, and they seem to be from a lover to his mistress or a husband to his young wife. Not really sure, but they talk about bad things that they've done.
Yeah, it says we ought to love each other because nobody, you know, anybody else, if they knew what we had done, wouldn't even talk to us. What's done can't be undone. The end of it, the guy had written, I tell you, there's nothing against us unless the dead could come to life. And the woman reading it wrote a note on there that says, they do. Basically, this guy who wrote the letter was lost at sea. And I assume that things didn't end well for the woman either. They look around a little more, muse about the letters, and then decide to go to bed, or at least to lay down in his clothes on the bed with the servant in another room. All his weapons are lined up next to the bed.
Yeah, just in case. I don't know what they think that they're going to be able to do with weapons, but if they think they're people, then yeah, that would
right.
Obviously weapons would help against people. So they kind of starts to fall asleep, and then he hears three knocks, and then his servant just comes flying out and runs by. Just he's getting the heck out of there, and he says, "Run, run! It's after me!"
And this servant, by the way, had been very confident and not very fearful before, so it's a huge change in attitude. You know, the narrator tries to follow him and keep him there, but it doesn't work. I mean, he's gone.
But the narrator decides to stay. He's going, "You know what? I've got a strong will. I'm not going to let this freak me out. I'm going to push through."
Yeah, and this is when we start getting into sort of his philosophy of what the supernatural is all about. And it's where the story starts to get really bogged down.
Yeah.
He says, "You know, you might think it's a little odd that at that point, after seeing my buddy run out, I wasn't more scared. But I've been doing this a long time. And I also have a theory that anything supernatural that happens has to be somehow connected to a living agency, an actual person. And it's not even supernatural, it's just something we don't understand." And then what he goes on and on about this. "It was my conjecture that all that was presented or would be presented to my senses must originate in some human being gifted by constitution with the power so to present them." So his idea is that there always has to be a person involved somehow. Then he sees this thing that this is really scary.
Yeah, this is pretty flippin' scary part.
It's some kind of manifestation forms itself before.
"It was a darkness shaping itself forth from the air in a very undefined outline. I cannot say it was of a human form, and yet it had more resemblance to a human form, or rather shadow, than to anything else. As it stood, wholly apart and distinct from the air and the light around it, its dimensions seemed gigantic, the summit nearly touching the ceiling. While I gazed, a feeling of intense cold seized me. An iceberg before me could not more have chilled me, nor could the cold of an iceberg have been more purely physical. I feel convinced that it was not the cold caused by fear. As I continued to gaze, I thought, but this I cannot say with precision, that I distinguished two eyes looking down on me from the height. One moment I fancied that I distinguished them clearly, the next they seemed gone. But still, two rays of a pale blue light frequently shot through the darkness, as from the height on which I half believed, half doubted, that I had encountered the eyes."
Whoa.
Yeah, it's flipping shadow monster.
Some kind of shadow monster. And he kind of masters himself at first. He's gripped with fear, and then he reaches for his gun. But his arm gets some kind of shock and is powerless. So now he's really, this is not good.
But he pulls it together.
Yeah,
and he goes, this is horror. This is not fear. Unless I fear, I cannot be harmed. You know, like, I do not fear. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the Paul Atreides and the fear's the mind killer, you know, that kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. He runs over and opens the curtains, and moonlight comes in, and that sort of, it banishes.
It's gone.
Earlier, his watch had been pulled off of his bedside table by something, and then something similar happens here where a hand just rises up next to his table.
And it gets the letters.
It pulls the letters down. It's the hand of like an old woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, just this disembodied hand comes out of nowhere and then leaves. That was very strange.
This stuff was really creepy and scary. And this is the thing with all ghost stories, man, that the buildup is always better than the payoff. Like when you find out what causes the haunting, or whatever it is, it's usually some really boring, mundane thing.
Yeah, it's exactly right.
It's what's going to happen in this story.
Well. Yeah. Well, we're getting to kind of a climax now. We've seen this apparition. They've taken the letters back, and then there's these knocking sounds keep coming and coming and coming, like these knocks that what happened right before the servant ran away. Then a story starts to get told here. He sees a woman's shape grow up from nowhere, and then another shape grows up, and it's a man's shape, a young man's shape in the dress of the last century. The male approaches the female, and then the dark shadow that was just described comes in again, and all three for a moment are all wrapped up together, and the shadow kind of grasps them, and we see there's a blood stain on the breast of the female, the phantom male leaning on his sword. It's very, you know, what's going on at that point? Were you following it?
I was really confused. And when I read it over a few times, and I'm like, okay, I'm sure this is all going to be explained later. But it's obviously the recreation of some kind of crime or wrong that was done.
And then it turns into the woman becomes an old woman, or an old woman just shows up and she's got the letters. And then kind of see where the crime might have happened. There's a face of a man long drowned. A corpse, and then beside the corpse, a child. Some people were killed. Okay. All that happens. It sort of disappears. There's nothing left but the shadow after that. And then there's a really, I mean, there's just some super Lovecraftian From Beyond stuff here.
Dude, it's totally From Beyond, yeah.
Yeah.
Here, check this out.
And the bubbles of light again rose and fell, and in their disordered, irregular, turbulent maze, mingled with the one moonlight. And now, from these globules themselves, as from the shell of an egg, monstrous things burst out. The air grew filled with them. Larvae, so bloodless and so hideous that I can in no way describe them. Except to remind the reader of the swarming life which the solar microscope brings before his eyes in a drop of water. Things transparent, supple, agile, chasing each other, devouring each other, forms like naught ever beheld by the naked eye. As the shapes were without symmetry, so their movements were without order. In their very vagrancies, there was no sport. They came round me and round, thick and faster and swifter, swarming over my head, crawling over my right arm, which was outstretched in involuntary command against all evil beings.
Wow, that is some...
That's just like From Beyond. I mean, it's...
The way that they're devouring each other.
Yeah.
And that,
Lovecraft had to have cribbed that a little bit, or at least that put a seed in his head.
All of the fiction that we've been going through, a lot of it connects back to From Beyond. That story really seemed like a distillation of so many of these ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. It's strange to be able to read an author's source material, the things that he read and inspired him, and then it really shows you where those ideas come from. And it's just that there's no such thing as an original idea. They just really, it's really coming true. The more we read these stories, I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, okay. I mean, of course, you put them together in an interesting way.
It's all in your execution, as with most art.
Exactly. It seems so fresh to me. Those things with Lovecraft. And
I know.
And but I read this now and I'm like, wow, this is much older than Lovecraft.
Yeah, exactly. Sad part of the story here, after the shadow kind of disappears, after all this trippy stuff happens and then the shadow disappears, he goes over to the fireplace and his dog has passed away. His eyes are sticking out. His tongue is hanging out. Froth around his jaws.
Wait, no, he didn't pass away, dude. He was freaking killed. His neck was broken.
I know. Why did I say pass away? As that was coming out, it was like I was trying to break news to a child or something. The dog's in a better place. He's playing in fields of dreams and angels.
And that's pretty much it. He stays the rest of the night there at this place and leaves in the morning. He doesn't hear from F, his servant, until he gets a letter from him a few days later, which says, hey, I'm in Liverpool. I'm moving to Australia. Sorry.
Yeah, that guy started running when he left the house and he never stopped. He's gonna be on a treadmill on the boat as he's going over to Australia, just still running, 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 running. I gotta get out of here.
He decides he's gonna go talk with Mr. J, the landlord, and try and figure out, you know, it's like, well, I saw these things. Maybe he can help me piece things together. Which he does. And this is the part kind of where it gets kind of, I feel like I'm talking to a dude when I was in college who had some ideas after he read some occult books about how the universe worked. And and this is the guy telling me all this stuff.
And you're stuck with him at
and
some
I'm
party.
Stuck. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because when he starts talking to the landlord, he comes up with all this bullshit about how, can you suppose that a mesmerizer... Somebody who can mesmerize somebody. Maybe they can also affect inanimate objects, like move a chair or open and shut a door. And then he says, well, actually, mesmerism couldn't do that. But there was a... He says, there may be a power akin to mesmerism and superior to it. The power that in the old days was called magic. I was like, what?
Yeah,
all you're saying is maybe there's magic. But you're taking a very long time to do it.
Yeah, he's taking a really long time. And it goes on for a long time.
It goes
time.
On and on. I actually... pulled out some lines here about, if just forget it, it's boring. Yeah. Basically, the guy's got some lame theories about how somebody could remotely haunt a place. I think really that's all he's saying. Somebody who had some kind of hypnotic powers could be in another location or maybe somewhere else even in time or something and be manipulating a home.
Yep, that's it.
It's that kind of thing that happens where somebody goes, I have a theory. And then you go, this story is about to confirm that theory exactly. And it makes me mad because the thing should happen first and then you should form some theory about it. You know, you can't just accidentally come up with something that's exactly right. That makes me mad.
It's really frustrating. That happens a lot in science fiction and fantasy stories and things as well.
Well, anyhow, he says he thinks the haunting has something to do with that room they were locked in.
Yeah, because that seemed to be the focal point of the house and the haunting mm-hmm. or whatever it is. So Mr. J goes, well, let me do some, and he talks about the letters and the old yeah. woman and the things that he saw. So he tells him everything and he goes, okay, well, let me do some digging around. Mr. J, the landlord, says this. About 10 days later, he gets some info from Mr. J and he's like, well, you know, the old lady that was kind of the housekeeper there that was wealthy before, well, a long time ago, she married this American that nobody liked and everybody thought he was a pirate. She had a brother who was rich and a widower. He died mysteriously. And then she got charge of the child and the wealth, all the money right. that the kid got. Then the kid dies, yeah. but it's an accident, supposedly. So she inherits all the money. And then the pirate guy this that she's hooked up with just beats feet and then is lost at sea with their money. She makes a bunch of, not all of the money, but a lot of it. And then she makes bad financial decisions. And then she keeps getting poorer and poorer until she's finally a servant. And then she becomes like the lowest form of servant. It's a pretty sad story. And so goes,
oh. It's the part in the haunted house story where you find out the tragic thing that happened in the past.
Right.
They were clearly greedy. They drowned her brother to mm-hmm. get his fortune. They inherited the kid. They couldn't get it all unless the kid was dead. So they neglected. Because it says...
Yeah, they really neglected, they didn't feed him, and they... and
Exactly.
Yeah, it was horrible. And
it was like a feral kind of little kid.
And yeah, they died. And, the kid died. Our narrator has this idea that he thinks that that room has some kind of telegraph line into the house, and that if they get rid of that room off the house, everything should go back to normal, and whoever's doing this will have to stop.
This is all connected somehow, and he says, let's rip up that room. There must be something going on.
It was built on separately on the house later, so it can easily be broken off. It won't be a big deal. So when they do that, they get into that room. They start knocking on the walls. They find a trap door. In the room, the trap door, they go down, and then there's this whole kind of weird alchemical hermetic. You know, it's got bottles, it's got phosphorus, it's got weird tubes and things, and there is a drawer, which has got a small little portrait of a guy. I don't know who this guy is supposed to be. He says he's like, you know, middle-aged, and he seems familiar to him at some point, mm-hmm. but that's all he says. And I don't know who that guy is supposed to be. When he opens up this cabinet, he finds this, what's like a compass floating in water, and it's spinning mm-hmm. around. And he goes, huh, this is interesting, but it kind of gives him a bit of a shock when he touches it, and he drops it and breaks.
Well, when he finds the compass, there's also a tablet of some kind with it, right?
Yeah, there's a little book with it.
I had opened the tablet. It was bound in plain red leather with a silver clasp. It contained but one sheet of thick vellum. And on that sheet were inscribed, within a double pentacle, words in old monkish Latin, which are literally to be translated thus. On all that it can reach within these walls, sentient or inanimate, living or dead, as moves the needle, so work my will. Accursed be the house, and restless be the dwellers therein. We found no more. Mr. J burned the tablet and its anathema. He razed to the foundations the part of the building containing the secret room with the chamber over it. He had then the courage to inhabit the house himself for a month, and a quieter, better conditioned house could not be found in all London. Subsequently, he let it to advantage, and his tenant has made no complaints.
They fixed it.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end.
I think I know what's going on here, or at least I think I puzzled out what happened in the end there. When they find the secret room, after breaking up that room, and they find that where the alchemist lived.
Yeah.
Yeah, they find that miniature portrait, right? It's mm-hmm. got, it's set in gold.
Yeah.
And it's of the man that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And then he turns it over, and there's a little pentacle and the date 1765, and then he finds this little spring in it, and he opens it up. And in the side, it says, Mariana to thee. Be faithful in life and death to Bond. And there he says, here follows a name that I won't mention, but it was not unfamiliar to me. And I think that's the Saint Germain.
That's Saint Germain?
I think so, because he said, I had heard it spoken by old men in my childhood as the name borne by a dazzling charlatan who had made a great sensation in London for a year or so and had fled the country.
Oh, okay.
Now, when he fled the country, he had done it on the charge of a double murder within his own house, that of his mistress and his rival. He killed somebody. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but he had to split, but I think it was like the house was so unhappy for him.
That he cursed the house?
Yeah, because so he put a curse on the house because of, it says that of his mistress and his rival. So was his woman making love to somebody else there and he caught them. Mm. And that was the double murder, right? And then he basically put a curse on the house for anybody that had lived there.
Yeah, whatever. The point is, it's kind of lame.
The point is, yeah, it's a pretty convoluted way to explain it. And even then, once something's explained, it's just not that scary anymore.
It's not scary. And that's what's so great about weird stories is you don't get an explanation. So that point of being creepy stays with you.
Because here, once you know all this stuff, you go, oh, it's some guy in breeches with a compass.
His little periwig.
Who cares?
Who cares? And it's, yeah, and it's just, it becomes so mundane. It becomes about these people's emotions and being angry and petty and all these things that are so human. And when you look at something that's more weird, it's so beyond humanity and it's more cosmic and bigger and scarier.
The book Hell House, the Richard Matheson book, has a similar ending, actually, where they find a secret room and there's a body in there of a man who had a will so strong that he's still controlling. It was actually very similar to the story.
Maybe this is a rewrite.
It's better written, but
I have to say, the people talking about him being like the worst author ever, it's pretty ridiculous because there's plenty of stuff out there that's way more horrible than this.
Oh, for sure. And you know what? Actually, I got a little offended on his behalf because when I was reading up about the Dickens thing, it said, after Dickens finished Great Expectations, he went to stay with his friend Bulwer Lytton. In the parentheses, it said, an author no longer read.
Oh.
I was like, how do you know that? Hey, I'm reading them right now.
Yeah, come on.
What a terrible thing to say.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed reading the story, even though it was kind of a letdown at the end. I was pretty scared, and it held me all the way until the scary black monster thing. And then I got a little confused after when the scene was being recreated. But yeah, I was totally on board. I dug it.
Yeah, I liked it. And then it was stupid. But
it was stupid. But, you know, that's ghost stories for you, man.
That's ghost stories for you. Thank you to John.
John Hancock, rocking it out. Thank you so much. And hopefully we'll have him back again. He did a great job. What's next week, Chad?
We've got more body part stories coming up. Next week, we've got a story called The Invisible Eye. You can link out to it from our site. After that, we've got another story called The Owl's Ear. So good eyes and ears coming up.
I love it.
So I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey. And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At HPPodcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.